Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
La-di-da, la-di-da.
He's looking at you, kid.
Let's put a smile on that face.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
I'm Tom Hall on Midday at the Movies. The putative blockbuster hit of the summer, Solo, a Star Wars story, is a bust. Star Wars has been part and parcel of American pop culture for 40 years. What's the deal with the latest installment in this iconic franchise? Anne Hornaday of the Washington Post and Jed Dietz of the Maryland Film Festival weigh in and suggest a few other titles you might want to sample this summer. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews On Your Feet at Baltimore's Hippodrome Theater. Midday starts right after the news. Ah, yes. If ever music could be referred to as sleazy, it's that arrangement of Hooray for Hollywood. It's cheesy and sleazy. Ladies and gentlemen, it is Midday at the Movies. I'm Tom Hall. Delighted that you've joined us. Jed Dietz, the director and founder of the Maryland Film Festival, is here. Mr. Dietz, always a pleasure, sir.
Great to be back.
And making a rare cameo appearance, ladies and gentlemen, from the Washington Post, Anne Hornaday. That's it. The Midday Whamma Jamma Blues Band Choir breaking into a chorus of the Hallelujah Chorus on the mere mention of your name, Anne Hornaday. It's nice to see you again.
Spoil me, sir. Thank you.
It's nice to see you. Indeed.
Thank you.
So, I mean, the last 4 or 5 months, you have been able to conjure some, you know, ridiculous excuse as to why you couldn't make it. You have run out of plausible reasons why you can't be here, and we are delighted.
Thank you.
So welcome back.
Thank you for all your support.
Good to see you.
It's good to be seen.
So I want to talk about Star Wars, this new movie. Solo, the Star Wars movie. And listeners, if you have seen this movie, you are in the great minority, because there's an awful lot of human beings on the planet who have yet to see the movie. I'd love to hear what you guys think about it. 410-662-8780. That's the number here at Midday. You can drop us an email, midday@wypr.org. You can send us a tweet at @MiddayWIPR. And Anne, you wrote a piece about this in the Post a couple days ago.
I can't remember what I said, so you have to remind
Well,
me.
One of the things you report
I
is that
agree with myself.
The movie cost $200 million to make. They are spending a reported $140 million to market it. And in the first weekend, it opened Memorial Day weekend, so there's an extra day in the weekend, you would think, right? It's a three-day thing. It grossed $100 million. I guess, Jed, it's up to 190 now?
95.
You know? And so, of course, in Hollywood terms, a mere $100 million for a virtually $400 million movie is jump change, and it's a bust. So, I mean, it Star Wars, the first one came out in 1977, right? So we're talking 40 years of Star Wars being, like, planted in our DNA, and this one blows up. So why do you think that happened?
Well, you know, I mean, I think it's probably multifactored, and I would love to hear, in addition to people who've seen it, I'd like to hear from people who haven't and ask them why. You know, I mean, I actually happened to, I went to visit my daughter's high school last week, Baltimore City College, and I asked those classes. I was very interested, and very few hands went up amongst those high school sophomores.
Who had even bothered to see it.
Exactly. When I asked who saw Star Wars, this was right after Memorial Day. And it was very clear that they just didn't feel that it was necessary. They just didn't feel impelled, compelled. You know, I personally happen to think that, you know, one of the stories around the making of the movie is how they replaced the directors. They replaced Chris Miller and Phil Lord, who had done the Lego movie. Mm-hmm. They have this very antic sense of humor, and it was thought that they would kind of bring that sensibility to this. They were fired, and Ron Howard comes on. And Ron Howard,
he's a very experienced director with lots and lots of hits to his credit.
True, but not a lot of imagination. I mean, I wouldn't go to him for anything new or novel. I would go to him to execute, which he does. You know, he's a very good executor, and he gets the job done, and he'll bring it in. He's a trusted professional. But I wouldn't go to him for particularly, you know, as a visionary or as somebody who's going to bring anything kind of really different and really, really genuinely new. And I do think that that was a miscalculation. I just think it's very by the numbers. I think there is a lot of strengths to the film. I don't want to completely dismiss it out of hand.
Yeah, but let's start with that. I mean, I haven't seen it, but that doesn't surprise listeners who know I have a pathetic life and I never go out. I finish the show. I go to Luke's house. We work on our stamp collection. It's mac and cheese at 5:30, and we're in bed by 8 o'clock.
I'm there.
Not together, but we're in bed in our separate quarters. So, Anne, I mean, is the movie a good movie?
Well, I think it's good. It's good. I wish it had been better, frankly. But, you know, what this is a standalone movie that purports to tell the story of Han Solo, who's one of the most popular characters from Star Wars, obviously played by Harrison Ford in the originals. It's his prequel. It's his origin story. So it's giving you a lot of these details that were only hinted at in those movies. Like, how did he meet Chewbacca? You know, how did he make the Kessel Run? How did he, you know, it's a lot of these little trivial notes from the Star Wars that they kind of act out. They cast Alden Ehrenreich as Han Solo. I thought he did a fine job. Yeah. That is subject to some debate, I think, out there in the ether. What else can I say? I think the people who stole it were Donald Glover, who plays the Billy Dee Williams role of Lando Calrissian, and then Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who voices this wonderful droid.
I mean, maybe, Jed, it's a matter of, you know, this franchise is so popular. It's so huge. It's so sui generis, I mean, compared to any other
movie.
There's
nothing like it, right.
That the standard just starts so high. I mean, here's Anne saying, you know, it's a perfectly good movie, but it's not great. But I bet it's greater than a whole lot of other movies, right?
Mm. Well, and there was this momentum in the year coming off a not-so-good year last year for blockbusters, perfectly good year in many ways. But and, you know, there was Avengers has done almost $2 billion. There was Black Panther, a bit of a surprise to people, obviously out of the comic book world, but this hadn't been done before, been talked about for years and never been done. And so there was this feeling that, huge weekends are just inevitable. And you've got it, you know, coming out of a great studio who's got great marketing skills. I totally what Anne said is right, that this thing was inside the film community, and because of its size and because it's Star Wars inside the larger community, it was damaged goods. You know, there was all these stories really were out there about, you know, in the production went over and it was a mess and people had, you know, Ron Howard had to come in. So I think that hurt it. And oddly enough, Disney, one of the great marketing companies on the planet of any product, I think really miscalculated taking this thing to Cannes. And I think it you know, in a festival
where it didn't fare very well.
Well, it got a 4-minute standing ovation. It was, but that was the night after Spike Lee's new movie that had blown the place up. I mean, the roof came off, and this didn't. The roof didn't come off, and it was very Disney presentation. A big fireworks display on the beach afterwards. The stormtroopers all around the Palais, and I just think it felt corporate, as opposed to, which I think this franchise is really built on the idea of not being corporate. You know, the great design stuff in this movie has always been, in these movies have always been sort of beat up spaceships and, you know, not just razzle dazzle stuff, but authentic things. Yeah. You know,
I talked to a guy named Derek Thompson, who's a senior editor at The Atlantic, and he wrote a really interesting book called Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity, What Makes Things Popular. Mm. And he talks about the public's tendency to be two things, both neophobic and neophilic, right?
Yes.
Meaning that
that's
you
well
neophobic,
said. Yeah.
You're afraid of stuff that's new,
exactly.
And you're resistant to change. On the other hand, neophilic, we're attracted to stuff that is new.
Yeah.
And he says, you know, to sell something familiar, the people who are really good at it, you make it surprising. Mm. And to sell something surprising, you make it familiar.
That's
so you've got to figure out that balance, you know. Star Wars is the hit of the century. Nothing like it had come before it. George Lucas, you know, tweaked it a little bit before he started it. But when it first got out there, and Derek Thompson suggests that one of the reasons it resonates so much is that it's this ancient myth.
Exactly.
That the story, this universal story of Star Wars is the same as Harry Potter.
Sure.
And, you know, but it's also the same as Moses and Muhammad and Jesus. You know, it's an age-old story. of the wandering, you know, hero.
And it had that retro, to Jed's point about the design elements, it had that scruffy retro look. It was B-movie-ish. It harked back to those serials. I mean, it had a lot of familiar touch points just culturally in terms of what it was referencing.
So is there an obligation then for Mr. Howard, who directs this movie, who's, as you say, an excellent director? I mean, he's done some wonderful movies. Is it incumbent upon him to blow that up?
Well, you know, here's what I've been reading since I wrote that story. There is a theory floating out there that this might be a reaction to The Last Jedi, because I guess a lot of the fans are very unhappy with The Last Jedi, and that they are now withholding their love because they feel taken for granted and kind of misused by that experience. Now, I happen to like The Last Jedi a lot more than this, because I did think Rian Johnson did come in and do some new things. Mm-hmm. Some of them worked, some of them didn't. But I sensed more of a willingness to take risks with that movie than I did with this one. This one really felt, I don't know, it just felt safe to me and kind of by the, you know, I've seen the train robbery scene a million times, you know, sort of like there were these sort of set pieces that did feel way too familiar. And I, but maybe they're reacting against the novelty of Last Jedi. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Barry in Pikesville, welcome to Midday with Jed Dietz and Ann Hornaday.
Yes, I was planning to see the movie last night, but since I don't have the internet, I had to use my phone to call theaters where I thought it might be playing, and I called the Senator. I'd already missed their last showing of the evening. I tried calling Hunt Valley. They didn't have their tape running, so I couldn't find out if it was playing there. And
well, as far as we know, Barry, it is at the Senator and here in town at the Rotunda at the Cine Bistro. So it's in those two theaters. And as far as we know, it's still there. So you can catch it tonight or, you know, over the weekend. But have you heard good things about it, bad things about it, neutral things about it? Are you going because you've gone to every other one? What's your take on why you're going to go in the first place?
Well, I'm a Star Wars fan. So it's a Star Wars movie, so I'm going to see it. And someone I know did see it, and they said they liked it. So, but, you know, my main complaint is I'm not on the internet. I wish there was some place, like in the paper, Mr. Deese could push for, where I could look up which theaters are playing what movies, and have, you know, instead of having to waste 10, 15 minutes sometimes calling different theaters, listening to their tapes, and finding out, oh, it's not there.
Well, that's one way of doing it, Barry, that's for sure. And I'm not sure we're going to be able to...
something in print.
We need something in print with ink.
Yes.
Yeah. Maybe there are people in Washington or Baltimore or New York who would be interested in producing such a thing. So, Jed, you saw the movie. What'd you think?
I liked it a lot. I mean, I agree with everything that's been said. But I think it fits into the world of Star Wars beautifully. It's sort of fun to see. It's a little too long, but I thought it was fun to see how Han and Chewbacca meet and how Han's character, this sort of rogue but honorable guy, you know, navigates through all the stresses of the interstellar world. So I enjoyed it a lot. I thought it was beautifully filmed. Bradford Young, we've talked about him before, who's this wonderful cinematographer, shot the movie.
Who has a home here in Baltimore.
Yes, he's based in Baltimore. And, you know, did a great job. I thought the design stuff was great. I thought the actors were really wonderful. There's a couple new characters that I assume we're going to see a lot more of. I thought it was fun.
Yeah. John in Washington, welcome to Midday with Ann Hornaday and Jed Dietz.
Yes, hello. How are you doing?
Good. How are you feeling?
Good. So I just wanted to call in response to one of the moderators said that she would like to hear why somebody is not watching. I am planning on seeing it, but I'm not in too much of a hurry because I'm mostly agreeing with her synopsis of Ron Howard doesn't really bring anything to creative process. And that complaint really boils down to what I think would be my complaint about the movie from what I've read about it so far is there are historic, iconic things that happened in Han Solo's life. And this is apparently supposed to be set 15 years before A New Hope happens. And they're trying to cram every one of those iconic things into the same, let's say, 1 year time frame that the movie is supposed to go into. So we're supposed to believe that all these things happen at once, and it just seems like there's nothing happening that forms him that would be addressed in the future of what would form him to bring him to a particular place and time he would see these people.
And interesting, John, because you're coming to that conclusion without having seen the movie, which is interesting because of what you've heard about it.
That's correct.
Yeah, that's interesting. But you will see it.
Yes.
I mean, have you seen every other one?
Yes, I have.
So, and obviously Star Wars, well, thanks for that call, John. I appreciate it. Obviously, Star Wars as a franchise can count on that, you know, if you've come this far, why would you get off the train now?
Well, right.
Well, they're questioning now. I mean, there are other Han Solo stories. I mean, there are multiple Star Wars stories in the works. And there's some thought that maybe the Han Solo character has been exhausted or shouldn't be, you know, front and center again. And we'll see.
Yeah, one of the criticisms has been that the women were subjugated here. They could have been played up more.
As you say
in your piece, there's three things about movies. Number one, it's an art form.
Okay.
Number two, it's a mechanism for mass entertainment. And number three, it's a profit-driven industry. Mm-hmm. And you're saying that all too often, not just Disney, but other studios are concentrating on number two and three.
True.
And they're forgetting number one.
Right. So, and I think they're putting their resources. It's like, and it's funny how they, now I remember what I wrote. They have a weird relationship to risk because it's a very risk-averse industry, but yet they're willing to spend $400 million, you know what I mean? Like their idea, to me, that's risky, you know? Like, why are you spending $400 million on anything? And you know, it's probably a better... I mean, look at probably the most profitable movie of the year so far is Quiet Place, which was, you know, cost nickels to make.
And it's grossed $300 million.
Exactly, because of ingenuity and imagination.
We got to take a break. We're going to come back. Before we go, Brian sends us an email, says, I was born the same year Star Wars came out. As a kid, those three movies became a big part of the national popular culture, and the fact that it was only three movies contributed to how special it was. In 1999, I was a senior in college. The first of the three highly disappointing prequels came out, adding three chapters that couldn't hold a candle to the original. Now, the franchise has decided to just mine for more and more money, coming out with four movies in the past 4 years. It's becoming too much, and the Solo movie in particular is evidence of the desire to tell a bunch of stories that don't advance the main plot line, which smacks of a primarily money-making effort. So I've always loved Star Wars, but I have no desire to see this because it just seems like they're going to put out more and more movies ad infinitum. It's not that special anymore.
Wow.
Very good. Well, thanks for that email. Brian, we are going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about some movies that people are very excited about seeing, in particular, a documentary about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the Supreme Court Justice. By the way, this little news item from the Los Angeles Times. Actor Jerry Maron died at the age of 98. He was the longest living
munchkin,
member of the Lollipop Guild. He was the guy who handed Judy Garland the lollipop in The Wizard of Oz. He died earlier this week at a nursing home in San Diego, California. We will have more of Midday at the Movies when we come back. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR, where you're listening to Midday.
The best use of muted trumpets in the history of Western music, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to Midday at the Movies. I'm Tom Hall here in studio with Jed Dietz and Anne Hornaday. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, another in our occasional series about women in politics. More than 80 women have now secured places on ballots across the country in races for Congress, the Senate, governorships. My guest tomorrow is Jennifer Palmieri, who served in the Obama White House and as Hillary Clinton's communications director in the 2016 presidential campaign. Her new book is an open letter to the woman who will eventually break the glass ceiling and be elected president of the United States. It's called Dear Madam President. I'll also talk with Norma Pera. She's retiring after nearly 40 years of teaching and leading the dance department at the Baltimore School for the Arts. So that's all coming up tomorrow on Midday. If you've just joined us today, as I mentioned, it's Midday at the Movies. Jed Dietz is the founder and director of the Maryland Film Festival. Anne Hornaday, the film critic for the Washington Post. If you'd like to weigh in on some movies that you've seen or planning to see or thinking about seeing, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. To find us on Twitter, @MiddayWYPR. To find me on Twitter and follow me, I'd be delighted if that happened. It's at Tom Hall, WYPR. So, Jed, let's talk about this thing that is another quite interesting phenomenon, and that is a documentary film about Ruth Bader Ginsburg has set the world on fire.
Well, and let's be clear about what we mean by fire here. It's done $8 million so far. So we're the failing $280 million Star Wars we just talked about. But it is sensational. And I saw it at Sundance. You know, it was made by CNN Films. They're yet another new entrant in the documentary film world. I think probably with no real plan to do theatrical. And there you could feel the excitement, and it's now viewable. It has been mixed in some mall cinemas with Solo and Deadpool, etc. And last weekend it won the weekend in some of those
theaters. It's outdrawing Star Wars.
Yeah, yeah. In some theaters.
Here's a little clip. The movie is called RBG.
I became a lawyer when women were not wanted by the legal profession.
Thousands of state and federal laws discriminated on the basis of gender. She was following in the footsteps of the battle for racial equality. She wanted equal protection for women.
Men and women are persons of equal dignity, and they should count equally before the law.
She captured for the male members of the court what it was like to be a second-class citizen.
The point is that the discriminatory line almost inevitably hurts women.
I did see myself as kind of a kindergarten teacher in those days because the judges didn't think sex discrimination existed.
RBG, Ann Hornaday, she's 84 years old and still going strong.
God, it's amazing. I mean, this is it's an interesting example of a little trendlet that I'm picking up on. We're going to talk about another movie in a few minutes about Fred Rogers. But there are these films coming out about these transcendent figures. It's almost like there's a response to the current political and cultural moment of people looking for folks that, you know, regardless of her politics, Ginsburg really embodies that ability to kind of rise above partisanship. Her friendship with Antonin Scalia is a big focus of the film. It's very much about her marriage. I mean, the kind of unsung hero of the film, not even unsung, the sung hero is her husband, Marty, who almost deserves a film in his own right in terms of
totally
like what kind of guy is so secure in his own sort of ego that he completely subsumes his own career to his wife's. So it operates on a lot of different levels, and it's just proven, it's just taken hold. And it was particularly popular over Mother's Day weekend when a lot of women went with their daughters and their granddaughters, and it's become kind of this cultural, it's just become almost like a ritual, you know, that a lot of women are doing together in groups with friends. It's really quite phenomenal.
Yeah. Let's talk about that other documentary that you mentioned. It's not open here in Baltimore yet, but it opens next weekend, which is Father's Day weekend.
And we had it at the festival.
And it was at the Maryland Film Festival. And this is called Won't You Be My Neighbor? Yes. It is about Fred Rogers, of course, the iconic star of you know, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. I didn't get to see it at the festival, but I hear incredible things about it.
Oh, it's so great. I have seen it with numerous audiences, all of whom are really moved by the film. Like RBG, and what Ann said is right, the surprise in that movie is this incredible relationship with her husband. Mm-hmm. The love for each other and very much part of the career and who they are. That sort of thing is in Fred Rogers, not so much because of the relationship with his wife, but I think our memory of him, and we all cherish him because of our children, you know, but it seemed like he was constrained, you know, the production values and the way he did the show and all that stuff, you know, public television at the very beginning, there were no budgets and all that stuff. And while there's truth in that, what you learn in this film is how purposeful his decisions were. And he voiced all those puppets on purpose. He made the sets crude on purpose. And the whole purpose was to communicate with children and make them feel stronger. And like no other entertainment figure I can think of, he did that.
Yeah, and Anne Hornaday, you write about voice and vision being the thing mm-hmm. that, you know, really yeah. matters. Let's listen to a clip. This is a movie, by the way, made by Morgan Neville, yeah. who did 20 Feet from Stardom.
Yep.
Linnell, my wife, loved that movie yeah. so much. She saw it 4 times in the
won.
Theater.
Oh, good for
she went
her.
She kept going with different people. I already made it through 2 of them, but she went 4 times. But this is Won't You Be My Neighbor, and it begins with a producer for Fred Rogers, Margie Whitmer, and talking about Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
We had a director that once said to me, you take all of the elements that make good television and do the exact opposite. You have Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Low production values, simple set, unlikely star. Yet, it worked. Because he was saying something really important.
Love is at the root of everything. All learning, all parenting, all relationships. Love or the lack of it. And what we see and hear on the screen is part of who we become.
Yeah, as you say, Jed, purposeful. Everything, I mean, love is at the root of all relationships or the lack of it. Mm. You know, so many kids were able to feel love from Mr. Rogers, even if they weren't getting love in their house.
You know, the revelation to me, I grew up sort of post-Rogers, so he was never a part of my personal life, but I was aware, I was Rogers adjacent. So I really didn't experience that necessarily firsthand. So I didn't know much about him. And you know, speaking to purpose, this was his ministry. I mean, he was literally an ordained Presbyterian minister. He went to seminary, and this was his way of evangelizing.
Yes.
And this was, he took it seriously on that score in terms of a spiritual vocation, spiritual mission and service. And so when he talks about love, you know, he's talking about Christian love. You know, he's talking about unconditional love. And I think what kids responded to, and again, it gets back to those low production values, was he didn't want anything in between him and that viewer, so that he could really see them, or that they could feel
being seen
yeah. and being heard. Mm-hmm. And he even describes in the movie that space between him and the viewer is holy ground.
Yeah.
And so I just think it's just a hugely, and then what I love about the film is that it's a great portrait and a chronicle, and it really does tell the story. But then Neville, the filmmaker, he does something at the end.
Ugh.
That is, I'm going to start crying even talking about it, but he really poses a challenge to the audience in terms of who are we now? Who do we want to be? What would he make of us? What would he make of this moment? And, you know, it's just, the movie just really goes one extra step, I think.
Yes.
In terms of it really confronting the audience.
So Nicholas,
engaging us.
Nicholas Ma, one of the producers, was here when we had it at the festival, and that sequence was put in at different places. They tried it at different places. And you're absolutely right. There's an emotional impact in the movie that's not just 1 minute. It crests at just that right moment. But it comes from this purposefulness. And so the movie, just as everybody aspiring to documentary filmmaking should see this movie, because it is so beautifully put together.
Yeah.
I'll tell you another funny thing that Nicholas told me, whose father, Yo-Yo Ma, is in the film and was a great friend of Fred Rogers, which I had no idea of that either. But he said that Fred, after he retired, he owned all the tapes. He had all the archives, and he would kept tinkering. He would have a revelation at some point about some little technical thing they had done in 1 year, and he would go back in and change the tape.
Wow. See, always
not above it. Revising
yeah.
history.
But yeah. Voice and vision. Voice and vision. So, Jed, let me ask you about a movie we talked about last month when we spoke right before or as the Maryland Film Festival was starting, and that's Matt Porterfield's movie,
yeah.
Sawler's Point, which played at the festival, and
yep.
it's at the Parkway still. How's yep. it doing? Matt's a local guy. This is his 4th film. Jim Belushi's in it, you know, some sort of marquee talent now. How's the movie doing?
Yeah, Porterfield is an international filmmaker now. I mean, and this is, I think, I haven't looked at all the numbers, but has had a really good theatrical run. He's mostly spent his life in really great film festivals, Sundance and Berlin, et cetera, et cetera. We were proud to be the first place it premiered, and it's done very, very well for us. We continue to play it through the weekend.
Right, another Baltimore movie, Soller's Point. Here's a little clip.
If you broke into my house, I'm going to have to press charges.
I don't blame you. I just wish you'd wait till morning. Think about it.
Carol, I don't feel safe. I feel like I have to get a restraining order.
Don't do that, please. Please, just sleep on it.
Now don't patronize me. I'm not going to be able to sleep tonight. Where is he?
I do not know.
What am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to do? I want to go home, and I can't go home, and I can't leave my house by itself, clearly. I have to call the police.
No. Please don't. Really, think about his position here. I mean, what are the cops going to do, really?
Are you kidding me?
Jim Belushi and Zazie Beetz. So good for Matt. I'm glad that movie has done well. Have you had a chance to see it yet?
Not yet.
Yeah,
no,
I haven't either.
On my list.
So I'm hoping to get to the Parkway this very weekend, as a matter of fact.
Jed,
let's talk about another thing at the Parkway. This is a movie called Let the Sunshine In, which opens in a couple of days. Juliette Binoche, it was at the Charles, and then it left, and now you're bringing it back.
Yep. Yeah, it's one of the missions, to keep films alive or bring films to town that haven't already played or wouldn't play without us. And this is one Claire Denis, this wonderful French filmmaker, and it did really well. It's doing very well in other cities around the country. So we're going to try and see if we can't find an audience for it. And so Let the Sunshine In is a charming movie. Another one to put on your list.
Yeah, and you've seen it.
Yes,
you think?
I thought it was real. Well, first of all, I love Claire Denis and I love Juliette Binoche. But her character, it's funny. Sometimes I get emails about certain movies. It's just funny what takes hold with people, and this is one of them. I'm getting more emails from readers who either took issue with my review. But she's a very galvanizing figure. Her character. She's an artist. She's getting on. She's middle aged, but she still wants to have a really passionate love life and a sex life, and she's looking for love and she's looking for lust and she's out there trying, and it's about her encounters with various different men who she think might be Mr. Right, might be the guy. And on the one hand, she's sort of I would almost want to say a pathetic figure in terms of what she's looking for and how she's looking for it. And to me, she seems like she's kind of stuck in the past in terms of the way she's dressing and the way she's. But then on the other hand, it's like, go for it, girl. like who's to say what's appropriate? I mean, you do you, right?
Yeah.
But the way that audiences are reacting to her is really interesting. Like, they either think she's terrific and great or that she's sad. And so it's that kind of a movie. Like, be prepared to go and then really be talking about it afterwards because she's quite a figure. And then there's kind of a revelation about her life midway through that puts her into even more of a judgmental space about where her priorities are.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Who is it that
intriguing
said,
movie.
Who is it that said you might as well be yourself because everybody else is already taken?
I love it.
That's a great line.
At the Charles Theater, this movie that you had at the festival, and I saw it there, Jed, First Reform. This is a very interesting movie with Ethan Hawke, who plays a pastor of a small church. Paul Schrader. He was Taxi and all
taxi
that.
Taxi driver.
Raging Bull. I mean, so you associate
as a writer, and this, and he's directing. Yeah. He's also directed other movies.
This was one spooky movie.
It is spooky, and it's full of dialogue and interesting theologic and interesting intellectual issues and dialogue. Every scene is packed with a sort of intensity that's so fascinating because there's nothing apparent in the scene. I mean, it's not like somebody's being stalked or anything like that. But this passion that you feel very early on makes for an incredibly intense movie-going experience. Ethan Hawke, who's is a wonderful actor, has done some great work in Boy's Life, et cetera, et cetera. This is the best thing by far I think he's ever done. And I say that with compliments to other things he's done. Amanda Seyfried, it's really fascinating movie. It's intense and perplexing. You'll come out another one for completely different reasons than the charming Let the Sunshine In, but you know, lots to chew on as you see this movie.
Seriously, my reaction to the movie is that I like it now, 3 weeks after I saw it, more than I liked it when I walked out of the theater, which was interesting. I think I was just so disturbing that it was just tough to get my arms around it.
I totally agree. I mean, I saw it at the Toronto Film Festival last year, and I was, first of all, Schrader himself is a fascinating figure. I mean, he was raised,
the director.
And this is very much coming out of his own. I mean, to me, this is the summa of his career, because he was raised in Michigan in this very strict Calvinist household. He wasn't even allowed to see movies for his, you know, young life.
You're right.
He saw his first movie, I think, as a late teenager. Then he goes to L.A. and he studies the films of Ozu and Robert Bresson. He comes under the tutelage of Pauline Kael. So he was very intellectual and very interested in the kind of transcendent, you know, he wrote a book called Transcendent Style in Film about Ozu and Bresson, who are these very contemplative, humanistic filmmakers. But he's got these rages in him and these anxieties and impulses which burst out in the script for Taxi Driver. So he's very attracted to pulp and sex and violence and visceral thrills. And so these competing sensibilities have always animated his work, but I think they are utterly expressed in this one in such a controlled way. I mean, it's just every scene, it's got this kind of, he has this kind of Kubrickian centering device where it's just two people in a frame talking, and you're just on the edge of your seat just by two people talking. But then it does burst forth in these paroxysms of very unsettling violence and graphic scenes that are kind of, they're startling, and they take you aback, and it does leave you very disquieted and questioning and talking.
But I would argue even some of the questions back and forth in those talking scenes are unsettling.
Of course,
because they're great big questions.
Yeah. Big questions. A couple of emails about some topics we talked about earlier in the show. Karen writes about movie listings. The Sun has evidently discontinued them in the hard copy of the paper. So she says, I and my friends complained to the Sun with no avail. My friends and I no longer go to the movies as much because of the problem of finding what's playing where. So again, you know, people who are not you know, inclined to look online have an interesting thing. William emails about his experience seeing the Star Wars movie Solo. Says, I'm 47 and I've loved every Star Wars movie, and I like Solo mostly because it's impossible for me not to. That said, I think Disney squandered an opportunity with their treatment of certain points of Hans's backstory. I found the revelations of how he met Chewie and how the Kessel Run was made to be disappointing. So, you know, people have different takes on it, but, you know, it's impossible for me not to. That's a Star Wars fan.
Right.
They're counting
interesting,
on.
Interesting. At the Senator, and there's a movie there called Ocean's 8, which guess is also part of a series,
franchise.
Sure. There was an 11 and a 13. I'm not sure why they don't do this in numerical order, but is Ocean's 8 a good movie?
It's fine. Yes, this is another example of a female reboot of something. So, like, we had the all-female Ghostbusters a few years ago. This is the all-female Oceans, and so it kind of it sort of takes the Danny Ocean story, and this is about his sister Debbie, played by Sandra Bullock, and it's just an all-star cast. It's got Cate Blanchett and Helena Bonham Carter and Rihanna making her big screen debut. And it's fun. It's a caper heist movie. I don't think it necessarily has the style or the brio of the Soderbergh movies. I mean, he just brings such intelligence and snap to his films. This doesn't have that snap, but it is fun and diverting. And I got to tell you, the MVP, Anne Hathaway, plays this vain, silly actress. It all takes place at the Met Ball. That's where the caper transpires. And she is just, I thought she was utterly delightful and hilarious and kind of self-referential in
She's
a really
a great
neat
actress.
Way. She really is. Yeah. And I mean, she takes her share of kicks online, I think. And she's just one of those people who has a target on her. And this is just such a winning performance.
So we're out of time, Ian, but we do have an email from somebody who wants to ask a question that happens to be the same one I had. It's another movie, At the Senator. It stars Toni Collette. It's called Hereditary.
Oh, yes.
Jack emails and says it's being called one of the scariest movies ever made.
Definitely. I would say it is. And it's a showcase for Toni Collette. I mean, you mentioned her. Everybody in it is really great. It's about a family in distress, really well made, very beautifully crafted. I think it gets a little, it slides into literalism toward the end, but
flat out horror, though, and very
graphic. But the suspense, that kind of Polanski-ish suspense at the beginning, is amazing. And she is It's great. Stunning. It's a great performance.
All right.
Her.
So you got the Parkway. We have the Generation Parkway series, which is tomorrow or Saturday, rather. Good thing to take the kids to. You
Never
got
ending story.
Bunch yeah. of good stuff at the Charles Theater and the Senator. So wherever you end up at the movies, I hope you have a good time. Ann and yes. Jed, always good to see you. Thank you so much.
Thank
we'll
you,
see you
Tom.
Next time.
Yeah. Thanks.
Ann Hornaday, the film critic for The Washington Post. Her must read book is called Talking Pictures, How to Watch Movies. Jed Dietz, the founder and director of the Maryland Film Festival. And we've got a link to Ann's reviews and the schedule of the films at the Parkway Theater. That's the home of the Maryland Film Festival. On our website, wypr.org/midday. Coming up, theater critic Jay Wynn Russick joins me with her weekly review. It's a musical about the lives of Emilio and Gloria Estefan. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Stick around.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.